This episode is sponsored by Game Time, the most convenient place to get concert tickets. Download the Game Time app or go to gametime.co. You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer. My guest for episode 246 is singer-songwriter Robert Diebel, who says he is promoting his seventh album. He actually had two albums before that, so starting way back in 1989. You're right now hearing The Forest from the Tree from that new album, The Space Between Us, and we'll soon be discussing The Attic of Desire from that album. Then we'll look back to his 2017 album, Beloved, and talk about the song Uncertain. Then we'll talk about the title track from his 1998 album, Earthside Down. We'll conclude by listening to Rockabye, featuring Victoria Williams, from 1994's Days Like These, his professional debut. For more information, please go to robertdiebel.com. For more about this podcast, go to nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic to support the podcast, which will get you an ad-free feed and all my notes used for these discussions. When you're drawing near. So I played a little bit of The Forest from the Tree, your latest single, released this last September, from The Space Between Us, your new album, and we're going to talk about a full song from that in a minute, and we'll go back further in your catalog. I will have already tried to sum up the arc of your career since the 80s in my little intro that I'll record later, but you tell me. I see that you had a couple albums that, as far as your official discography, no longer exist, so you start off in, what, 1994 with the Days Like These?
I have a couple of cassette tapes that was sort of me first starting to write. That was done amongst a small group of friends that I'm still in deep contact with, but they've always just kind of stayed on cassettes and people hunt for them, and that's kind of fun, but I haven't made them widely available. There's no reason for that. Just, I think when I start with my first album, Days Like These, stepping in with my best foot forward, I guess.
Sure. I mean, even on Days Like These, some of it, I don't know, I like to listen to some of these with my elderly father, who is a folk singer, and he's like, I can't understand any of the words. So in other words, I hear, so I've sort of taken that to heart, and I really try to make my lyrics, you know, especially, you know, somebody like you who crafts lyrics, but your default singing style is, I'm going to stay down here, and I'm going to kind of do this Leonard Cohen kind of thing, which can be very clear, but I'm hearing on Days Like These, some of the sort of emo, a little bit, like the 90s, you know, you put the vocals lower in the mix, kind of, whereas, you know, even by Earthside Down, they're kind of front and center, and like, I'm the singer-songwriter. I mean, that's the only sort of change in your career I can detect, and that was so early that I don't even know if, has there been any, you know, notable evolution in your style that you could point to, you know, between the old stuff and the new stuff?
Well, you do see a little bit of tie-in midway through. Heart Like Feathers has a lot of returning to some of that falsetto. Mm. In fact, some of those notes I can't hit anymore.
Oh.
But the title track, Heart Like Feathers, has this really lovely ah that hits right in the middle in the bridge. And it's the high point of the song. And it's a very high note. You'll hear a little bit of that in Earthside Down on songs like Anastasis. Again, another higher note that's difficult sometimes to reach. But I have a funny little story about not Leonard Cohen. What's the producer's name? The Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
T-Bone Burnett.
T-Bone Burnett. He had told me around the time of Days Like These, his advice to me was sing in your talking voice. And it's kind of a funny story because I did Earthside Down and I kind of reoriented the way that I approached that. And I sent it to him at the end of that record, and he said the same thing. Sing in your talking voice. I think he just says that to everybody that reaches out to him.
Well, let's listen to this one off that you picked off the new record, The Attic of Desire. Do you have a few words to say about it, you know, as to where you're at with this album and this song before we hear it, and then we'll talk in more detail?
Yeah, I picked this one for you specifically because of kind of the nature of your podcast and how you look at different areas of a songwriter's evolution and career. This was an interesting tune because we had covered it on a previous album. It was covered on our 2003 13 Stories album, and it was a little bit more of a bandish sort of indie rock kind of you know, approach. But this song grew on me in very different ways over time. I wanted specifically to redo this song as it had come to mean different things for me. You know, I think initially when I first wrote it for that first album, it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek apology to my wife for being a musician. In fact, it was initially called A Formal Apology. That was the name of the track on that album. I, over time, really began to think more about that tune and wanting to redo it in a different way. It meant something different to me over time, and that was really taking stock of the things that really matter around you and the people that really matter around you, and not letting them be taken for granted in light of an artistic career or any kind of career that's driven. And I leaned a lot more into the chorus on the second time through. Rich Hordinsky and I wrote a much more strategic string part for the song. That's a little bit of what's behind the recording of this, and I renamed it The Attic of Desire.
All right, let's insert it in full, the new version of The Attic of Desire from Space Between Us 2025.
Sleep till wake, it's late, you work too hard. And all that I wanted to tell you lies shrouded. Spent in ventures far too grand, like best laid plans that fail due to the weight of intentions as youth and its glorious ascension. Stones by the fuel of its dreams, like the bird that fell from the wire, fell as she sang like a beautiful lyre. The house troubled by fire, you were the priceless thing in the attic of desire.
Beautiful life, and I was
the attic of desire.
So interesting, even just, you know, this long pickup note intro before everything comes in. And even though those are real strings, I initially thought it really gives that vibe of a Fool on the Hill Beatles Mellotron.
Oh, I love that.
Dee-doo-dee.
Yeah. I thought that too when I heard it when we got the mixes back, and I'm like, oh, I love that. We weren't exactly sure how this was all going to play out until we kind of felt it in the mix.
So, but you're in that pickup, you're playing something on, are you playing nylon on most of these, or?
I do play nylon on this guitar, and that was to kind of create more of an intimacy around the song.
Maybe this is long enough ago since you wrote this 20 years plus ago. I did not realize that. So you've got the melody, and then you're, oh, maybe I should double that on my guitar. Was this during the recording, or this is something you have always done live, or was this right from the start? Maybe you wrote it on guitar and then added the vocal.
So first of all, I'll just make a quick point. There's two types of songs that I end up writing. Some songs are written poetry first, and then the song structure has to follow whatever those poetic lines are. And other songs are written melody first or song structure first, and then the lyrics have to follow whatever that structure is. So this is an example of kind of a lyric first song. This was initially just a poem. And so there you have that very, very long stanza, a lyrical introduction. That's one of the things that makes it kind of interesting, and one of the reasons I felt like I wanted to redo it, because I felt like I didn't lean into it quite as much as I wanted to. But so that was always part of the song structure from the beginning. But what really shifted and changed is the way that we began to structure the strings into the song, and how that significantly changed kind of how the structure of the song played out. The second thing would be how the backing vocals were utilized in the song. And this was really kind of a discovery for me. This is one of the things I think Rich Hordinsky is extremely good at. What I noticed in the studio as we would go back and forth on creating this, recording this, he utilized backing vocals like an instrument. There's two different backing vocalists on this song, and the way that they come in and out, it's like almost like a horn part that would come into a song. And that significantly changed the way this song played out versus the initial recording of it. I like them both, but I'm quite fond of what we came up with this. So much more lush, and I think it kind of encapsulates this idea of the chorus, the attic of desire, the thing that we've left in the attic that is where our heart is really at.
Do you know if the two women on here were together in the studio singing together like a little choir, or was it bringing one in, hey, do some stuff, do see what appeals to you, and then the other one comes in and comes up with completely different stuff? Because there is, you know, there's the there's the descending vocal line in the chorus, mm-hmm. and then there's, well, mm-hmm. some of it's doubling you. And at one point I noticed they were kind of together, but one of them is being more staccato than the other. So I didn't know if that indicated that they were not there on the same day, or that they were there, but they just weren't trying to be so synced up.
No, very good observation. The latter.
Okay.
So in many ways, this kind of represents a little bit of how Rich would approach an arrangement and how I would approach an arrangement, because I kind of utilize a lot of that shadowing effect that Leonard Cohen would use back in the day. You know, the backing vocal will add a little more light to your present vocal kind of in the background. So you hear a little bit of that, and that would be Lacey Brown. And then you hear the other more prominent vocals that are more like an instrument. Rich did those prominent backing vocals first, and I was like, wow, that was never in my trajectory, and loved it. But I also came back and said, I want to still touch on a couple of these lyrical lines, and let's use a different voice for that.
Well, so let's listen to the chorus here where that prominent one comes in.
Like the bird that fell from the wire, fell as she sang like a beautiful lyre. And I was the house troubled by fire. You were the prize.
Yeah, so just as if he was arranging strings. We're just going to have a voice do that instead. So that's the Chaya Jones. Is that who?
That's Chaya Jones. Okay, Chaya Jones.
Mm-hmm. So that's just a friend of his that does stuff with him? Or was any of this done, this new album, sending something to somebody across the country where they send you a file back? Or was everything getting studios?
A lot of okay. That. It was a combination of Camp Diebel and Camp Hordinsky. So we have West Coast and
he's in Ohio, is that right?
Yeah, he's in Ohio.
Okay.
Cincinnati, Ohio, yeah.
So when you're using Victor Krauss on bass, right? He's a big deal, I believe.
So, he is a big
deal. So where
deal.
Where is he? Is he in yeah. his own studio somewhere else, or is he an Ohio guy?
Rich would use Krauss anytime he came in through town at Rich's studio.
Okay.
Krauss works a lot with Rich on different projects.
And I forget if he also played, because Uncertain, the second song we're going to play, has a very prominent bass part. If that was a different, I didn't write down who played.
Different player.
Yeah, okay. But you like the, so they're all playing upright, right? Generally, you like to stick to upright or no?
There is a lot of upright on my albums. And I'm trying to think. There is a little bit of electric bass on this new album. And I think 13 Stories, the record I was referring to earlier, that was more of an indie rock type of thing. And that was all just regular electric bass.
Yeah, the credits on this new song says you did a little drum machine, even though Dan Phelps is playing drums. I couldn't detect drum machine anywhere. What?
I have to think about that. All of these songs were initially created with drum machine that I would do at home. And then a lot of times we'd either leave some of it in a prominent way, or we would kind of pull it far back into the mix as almost an ambient texture. And I'm trying to think how that worked on Attic. And I can't remember, honestly.
Okay, so there might be some stuff left over, or even, you know, you played it, whether it's there or not.
Yeah.
Whether it all got removed or not, you did play it. So really interesting. I guess part of the, you know, this being a poem and then laying it out helps to explain some of the really interesting phrasing on this. You know, just things coming in on the and of two or whatever, and all that I wanted to, you know, just this very interesting, I was going to say church-like, but that's not the word. Yeah. Do you know what you're channeling in terms of these choices or this?
Yeah, it's more of a spoken word type of aesthetic. In fact, I worked with a couple of different poets as I'm writing or rearranging the tune, just to kind of get into their head of how they would phrase it on paper. You know, because I always find it interesting, the interconnection between lyric and poet, you know, it's kind of a weird crossover with me, but I always admire poets that can capture your attention just with the words.
Let me play a little bit of I want to get the transition between verse one and verse two.
Light shrouded. Misspent in ventures far too grand.
That was a big change, actually, from the original tune, or at least the string arrangement. That was a part where I stepped in with Rich and said, this isn't working. I need to come to a full stop here, and we need to pause the strings so that we take a breath and that the listener can appreciate what just happened and then move into the next phase. And I think once we gravitated towards that, the song really began to take more shape. You know, songs like this, they are a mess in the studio. It is still being formed while all the parts are there, if that makes sense. You know, some songs you can rehearse with a band and you can go into the studio and it sounds like what you did as a band. Other times, the studio is its own instrument. It's its own creative blank canvas. And we're literally massaging the song or changing its structure within the studio itself. It's kind of that George Martin approach.
Let me turn to the lyrics a little bit. I mean, setting it up as a formal apology. Okay, this gives me a lens of interpretation. Whereas I wasn't sure when you're saying, say in the second verse, misspent adventures far too grand, like best laid plans that fail to the weight of intentions, as youth and its glorious engine stalls by the fuel of its dreams.
I love that.
You know, very poetic, made less pretentious by, you know, actually putting it in a nice,
like it doesn't sound. I feel like I just did a disservice to it reading it aloud in that voice. If it's an apology, well, then you're obviously talking about you're characterizing your own activity and your own an apology for being a songwriter to my wife. That would have been a good full title to just because every songwriter can, you know, at least who has. Yeah, probably anybody who's involved in any artistic endeavor and, you know, neglects people from time to time again, or at least is mm-hmm. out too late at night or gone, you know, touring or whatever, can identify with that. Yeah. Any thought about those choice of phrases?
You know, I don't want to take away from what the song might mean to someone else that falls in love with it for their own reasons. But for me, you know, that very first stanza is about my wife and how hard we both work. But sometimes in like a passionate field like the arts, there's so much excitement and passion around what you're doing and your partners, you know, a school teacher or working in a corporate situation and it's not life-giving and you're both kind of just working really hard to keep everything going and so that's kind of for her, you know, sleep don't wake, it's late, you work too hard. My mind goes off into the story of our lives, the artistic story of our lives as a couple, and how if I could just tell her all I wanted to tell you lies shrouded, misspent in ventures far too grand, the idea that you're going to be a songwriter, you're going to be a filmmaker, or you're going to achieve something great for the world. And like best laid plans that fail to the weight of intentions, we all have these kind of setbacks in the process of creating. It's part of creating, unfortunately. And then as we get older, you can feel that shift between that blissful youth and the intentionality of your goals and sometimes the pragmatic reality of it all. So it's not a song about failure, but it is a song about just acknowledging the hardship that comes in anything passionate and how that affects a partner. And I do love that very last line. It always makes me laugh. Stalls by the fuel of its dreams, as youth in its glorious engine stalls by the youth of its dreams. It doesn't die, it just stalls.
I need to stop and I want to tell you about a new sponsor, Game Time. I like, as you would expect, to see live music. Getting the tickets, I'm not as excited about. I have to follow various venues. Each of the venues has its own portal with a login. Maybe I see tickets that look good and then I go to checkout and, oh, the fees make it much more expensive. I don't want to do this at all. Game Time makes it very simple. I can browse music by genre. I can look up particular artists. I can look up particular venues. Creating an account on the site was virtually instantaneous, so they know where I'm located. And here, let me just show you how quick this is. I'm at the site, gametime.co. Of course, there's a mobile version too. So I just open up alternative rock. Hey, the Wallflowers, haven't thought about them in a while. I would like to see them. I see they do have a show coming up in Madison in June. Before I even click through, I see that the cheapest tickets are $111, and that includes fees. It takes me right to those cheapest tickets. I see their two seats together. I see that Game Time guarantee, best price, or we'll send you 110% of the difference. I click, it lets me pay with credit card or Google Pay or PayPal. Place the order, bam, the whole thing was done in the time I've been talking to you. Now, I like that in one place, I can see all this different music, plus theater, plus comedy, plus sports. I like that even just looking at, say, the various listings for a venue, it shows the cheapest ticket price right there for every single one without clicking through. I like this Game Time low price guarantee. I like that the purchase is covered with the most flexible customer service policy in the industry. There's event cancellation protection. There's job loss protection. That is, you lose your job. You don't want to pay for these tickets anymore. Game Time will always guarantee 100% authentic tickets on time at the best price. So take the guesswork out of buying your concert tickets with Game Time. Download the Game Time app, create an account, and use the code NEM for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and redeem the code NEM for 20% off. Looking at the chorus for a second. So, right, I was the house troubled by fire. You were the priceless thing in the attic of desire. If it doesn't have a definite meaning or it seems to ruin it, to literalize it or something, let's not talk about this. But I'm just wondering about labeling her the attic of desire or the thing in the attic of desire. What? What does that mean?
there's part of me that's never labeled it too distinctly as well. I love it when sometimes words are felt more than have a literal meaning to them. And this is one of the mysterious lines that I have a lot of feelings around, and yet there's not a very specific, this is what this means. But in general, the house is our lives. And sometimes the thing that's really most priceless for you is not the dream or the vision or what it is you're trying to obtain with all of your drive, but rather the relationship that sometimes gets put in the attic. And if you've ever crawled up in the attic on the week before Christmas to get your decorations down, and you see something that reminds you of your relationship or reminds you of something beautiful in your past, and you're filled with just that gratitude for whatever that thing is reminding you of. And I think that's kind of what that is speaking to.
Well, and I'm just now thinking this might be a one coherent metaphor. I was thinking, oh, I was troubled by fire. You know, I have to do the art, you know, whatever. I have my demons I have to address, but you know, you're priceless. You know, I want to keep that in mind. But if you have a house that's troubled by fire, well, what is the status of the things in the attic? You're least likely to go get them when you're running from the house. The fire it reaches them last, right? If it starts downstairs somewhere, it probably didn't start in the attic. Anyway, was it a single metaphor such that the house and the attic are actually connected, or no?
I don't think it was a single metaphor, but I think that all artists are troubled by fire. In some ways, we're all like Captain Ahab searching for that great white whale, and sometimes so vexed by it that we lose sight of everything around us, which is really more important in the light of things than whatever it is we're trying to create for the world.
And I see how the first lines of the chorus, like the bird that fell from the wire, fell as she sang like a beautiful lyre. I mean, it just presents a nice image of, again, maybe not failure, but as it's not working out. The lying seems to be, you know, at least just reading in the context, the dreams of success and whatever. So is it like the dream? It's not you that's falling. It's no. The dream that's plummeting. Okay. But again, that's a separate metaphor. Even though you're saying like this thing, I was the house. You're not actually talking about yourself.
The bird is not me, but perhaps the dream. And, just a tongue in cheek there, when I initially titled the song A Formal Apology, I wasn't quite sure whether it was an apology to my wife or an apology to Leonard Cohen for alluding to him in the song.
It sounds like some of the keyboard noodling, the tremolo guitar, that this was all just Rich putting in things.
This one was a bit laborious. We initially recorded it. The way that Rich and I would work on this album is that I would create sort of a drum loop for timing, and then I would create a very basic skeleton track at home, tracking my guitar and vocals. And then I would send that to Rich, and those would both be scratch. But we would use that guitar and vocalist as basically the the skeleton that people could follow. And then Rich would bring in a drummer to play on it, a bass player, or I would bring in a drummer. It depends on which direction, which person we were using, my coast or on his side. And then we would gradually start filling it in. And once we had everything in place, then there would be a lot of massaging in the studio of how we presented all of these tracks. Now, in this particular song, I initially recorded it faster. We had gotten, you know, 3/4 of our way finishing this song, and I wasn't happy with it. It took me a while to commit that I wasn't happy with it. You know, I was playing the song out live a little bit more and working with some different people. What I was trying to achieve vocally and conceptually worked a lot better slower. And so I threw Rich a curve, and basically I had Dan re-record this on drums at his studio here in Bainbridge, Seattle area. Resent the whole song to Rich, which meant we lost all those initial tracks and all that kind of stuff. And Rich was like, oh my gosh, this is so much slower. What are you doing? But it worked out. It achieved, I think, what I wanted it to do. So yeah, a lot behind this song and the recording of it.
All right. I feel like we should move on to the second song just because we've taken so long in this, but I have to ask you about the structure here, because, right, we have one chorus.
Yes.
And then we enter what sounds like an outro. And yes, it does have another chorus after that. But we have this quite long, what, like a full minute of reverse cello and you have this guitar solo that, yeah. So what's the story of the adding the guitar solo that you did not play? That's just sort of filling in where, you know, where you're doing this descending thing, the oohs are in there.
Well, again, the song is a representation of the type of work that I do that's lyric first or poetry first. And so it doesn't have that usual song structure of 16 bars of verse, chorus, 16 bars of verse. And this one is definitely very weird in that it has one long verse and then a chorus, a bit of an instrumental, and another chorus. The instrumental was one in which it was initially 16 bars. Not the instrumental, but the solo was initially 16 bars. And I suppose some people would be disappointed to hear that because Rich is such an amazing guitarist that they might have wanted to hear more. But I felt it didn't honor the song going that long. The song was already long enough and I wanted to kind of pull it back. And so we cut that back to just eight bars. And I've been trying to learn that guitar solo ever since.
And then just to get back into that final chorus.
Like the bird that fell from the wild, fell as she sang like beautiful life.
Which I initially thought was the end of the song. That, you know, because it sounds like this is the bill, but okay, we're going to put another chorus, which is nice because it's a short song anyway, and, you know, it's a nice chorus. Any thought about just how you were constructing that bill? Okay, we're going to have everybody play these eighth notes together. We're going to have some light cymbals come in that just, you know, for that those 9 seconds or so.
Yeah, it's that little emo part of me kind of peeking its head back out, and I leaned in on that a little bit with the drummer and with Rich. I think that Rich was soloing over that part and I pulled him back and said, I just want the intensity of that build. I don't want our minds going off onto the solo. I want the listener to feel that build and then the release of the vocal again.
All right, well, let's get the second song out there. If that was Leonard Cohen, this is Lou Reed. Uncertain from Beloved 2017. You want to say a little about this before we hear it?
Well, that whole album, Beloved, is very, very personal. It was written about my daughter. We were foster parents to her initially, and then over a period of time, she became our daughter, and we have a very sort of large extended family with her birth mom and siblings and all of that kind of beautiful stuff. So this tune was actually written about her name, and her name has two meanings. When you look it up, her name does literally mean the word uncertain, but it also has another meaning, which is beloved. And so this initial song was kind of about the period of time in which we were very uncertain as to how long we would be able to spend our life with her. You know, we cared for her for a full year, and then she was reunited to her birth mother, and we maintained a really good relationship with her, and were able to be godparents in that situation. And then 3 years later, we were able to adopt. So this is kind of in that transitionary period before she was adopted of just trying to be supportive in any possible way that we could and make life more seamless for her because there were so many different stops and starts and traumas and things like that.
Falling in the wind.
So we're doing the sing as you speak. We're going to be in this range. It's going to be... Yeah, and he thought about when you're putting a little diaphragm into it, when you're just talking, just is it the type of poem that you were delivering here that called for this kind of delivery?
Not so much a poetic structure as you're on mark with the Lou Reed thing. That's a huge influence, but kind of speaking the lyrics in the verses and then singing them in the... chorus. And so the chorus kind of lends itself to more of that emotive type of songwriting, or maybe even a little bit of Red House Painters or something along those lines, where I just wanted that feeling of awe to come into the chorus. And it's kind of fun how the strings come in there and add to the structure of the song.
What about this initial riff then, that then the bass ends up elaborating? I won't say doubling, but yeah, in fact, how dictatorial were you with the bass player? Was this, you had this guitar riff and the bass player came up with something that goes with, because the bass riff ends up sort of selling the song, much like, you know, Take a Walk on the Wild Side, the very famous bass riff, which I don't remember who the player was. I knew as of yesterday, but who you know, gets no writing credit for that, does not make royalties for that. I know this is not being used in ads all over the world. It's not the same thing. How are you working with your band to work out these parts?
So that's Tony Green on bass, one of my LA players. Tony was also involved on Earth Side Down. He was part of that community or band community back in the 90s with me when I lived in California. And I think Tony just very intuitively kind of picked up on my influences there. You know, he heard the guitar stanzas, which were done on a nylon string guitar. That whole record is nylon string. And he just kind of stepped into that in that sort of way that I think he intuitively knew I was thinking about, as well as Anton Arvisu, who is also one of the primary players on Earth Side Down. So he would be drumming on this record. I flew back to California to record those parts, the whole album with the two of them. I started recording the guitar and basic vocal tracks in Seattle, and then stepped into the studio in California, and then they did all the supporting tracks, and then went back to Seattle and finished it up in the studio there.
And it doesn't sound like these are rich arranged strings. Do you remember the story of the strings?
No, with one very big exception. This album becomes sort of the turning point in which Rich and I really start working together. I'll just say a quick word around how my relationship with Rich started out. He was in a band called Over the Rhine, and I would, in the 90s, open for them from time to time. We'd be ships passing the night or whatever. We didn't really get to know each other. But later, probably 10 years ago, he reached out to me and said, "Hey, I'd really like to do a record for you. What do you think?" And at the time, because of the distance between us, I could not imagine it. And I just said, "I don't know how it can work, because I got my people on the West Coast, you got your people in Cincinnati." And so we just, you know, as a bee in the bonnet type thing, we said, well, let's just keep our eyes on the possibility and see what happens. And so, you know, 2018, I was recording Beloved in Seattle, and all of the string tracks were basically just very basic stuff that I had worked out with my players. But the title track, Beloved, was something I really wanted to spend a little more time on. And I reached out to Rich and said, "What would you think of writing a string score for this?" And it was the first time I'd ever worked with Rich on arranging. Rich had stepped into an album prior to that. And no, that's right, 2018. So probably 2008, I was doing Heart Like Feathers, and Rich did a guitar track for me on that. So that's kind of how we began starting our relationship working together. But after that string score for Beloved, that was a turning point. And from that point on, I would send Rich basic compositions that I was coming up with and ask him to write a score. This was before we even started doing an album together. And so Rich kind of became our fifth Beatle, if you will, our George Martin or our Brian Wilson. And so Rich wrote the score for Beloved, and you'll hear a tie-in to, you know, what is on this current record with that particular piece. It's a really gorgeous part that he wrote for that.
So on this song, you're pretty much holding them in reserve. They're just, you know, doing a little drone. It's basically using them as a keyboard. And then in the chorus, you know, we have a nice big chordal part that, you know, I think just repeats the same way every chorus.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of using the strings like what, you know, Red House Painters would use a guitar, a ambient guitar part for, just holding down fifths and thirds and things, you know, basic pads to kind of give the sort of supportive structure for the vocal just to kind of sail across the water, if you will.
Let's hear the chorus here. So 54 seconds in. Couple things in there. So yeah, let's talk about the use of the harmony vocals in this one, which in fact persist after you drop out. Then you just have them take over, which is a nice little hollowed out thing. Yeah, any thought about it?
This is a beautiful cast of singers on this album. Tomo Nakamura is just an amazing songwriter here in Seattle that has really done some wonderful things, and you're starting to hear a lot of his music on soundtracks and things like that. And then Jen Wood is also prominent on this vocal. She was the vocal that everybody will remember from the Postal Service, their big hit with the duet that they did. So those two vocals are prominent throughout all of Beloved, and they kind of provide that dreamy landscape that we, you know, co-created there. And as well, you know, I think that like Tomo's vocals kind of give a little bit of a hearkening back to some of those higher end vocals that I used to do, say on days like these that you noticed.
A little picky thing. I think I originally, I pulled the lyrics off your Bandcamp page, and there it said, "Let down your hair. It's flying in the wind." Whereas it's clearly flowing in the actual song. Was that a change that was made at some point? Because actually flowing doesn't make any sense. Flying is the literal, you know, flying around in the wind. Yes.
Yeah. Good catch. It's probably just a misstep on the part of putting lyrics in, or it was a misstep in the studio where I sang a different word than I actually wrote down. I would have to check my journals to see what I had initially intended.
Okay, so you don't have any particular memory of a conscious choice.
Yeah, you've caught something I hadn't noticed. There are little things like that that I stumble onto from time to time. I think there's also a thing, you might have picked up on this as well, to where the chorus is uncertain. I think they flip around. It's not singing the same thing each time or in the same order. Either that or I just keep getting really confused live because I will often kind of goof that up a little bit. I think it actually kind of happened in the studio, but it sounded so good we just kept it.
Right. I believe it was the first chorus, at least what I copied out of your Bandcamp, I had to change. I had to flip it around because maybe you just sang it wrong that one time or what. Like, I didn't notice it then going forward.
I notice it every time I do it live because my brain gets all scattered and confused. But I think at the time I heard it and realized, oh shoot, I flipped the lyrics on the chorus. It's not the same time each time, but it really sounds great. And I think I'm just going to leave it.
As we'll see more on the final song that we're later going to highlight here, When You Sing High, it's like a different person has come into the room. So here you have Uncertain that you're I assume is you, but you put it in a different stereo space with a different effect, and it can be this little lonely thing. Yeah, it's a different character in there. Any thought about, again, that versus the background vocal, which is very wispy and different than you, versus this other thing?
Yeah, you know, my vocal range is kind of weird. There's like, I have a little bit of a high and then a lot of mid and low, but there's a significant portion that's missing in between the two.
Uh-huh. And
so it's probably the reason why I will pick one or the other, because if I get too close to that dead zone, it will become truly dead. Maybe that's something I need to work on, but I just kind of accepted it as part of the uniqueness of who I am.
Any thought about just the overall structure of this, that we're going to, again, kind of have we're going to repeat the chorus basically over and over again, but the vocals are going to drift off again, leaving some of the harmonies there. But even then that goes away just to give us an instrumental of indefinite length, which you could have made much longer. You could have put a solo in here. Mm-hmm. Any thought about not doing that? That this one is the main guitar part and the bass part are interesting enough that we're just going to focus on that. And maybe with a little bit, like the drum is so sparing with fills on here.
The big thing with the drums is that it switches over to the kind of that classic Seattle, what you would normally hear on a grunge song, where it comes in, I think on the end of three, the accent, and it just kind of starts to create this very hypnotic sort of aspect of the song. But I think that's one thing I do really love about this song, that I allowed it to stay simple. You know, being a lyrical guy, I'm prone to make things a little too complicated sometimes. And yet a lot of the music that I love is very simple. So this reminds me of kind of the simplicity of a low tune that just relies more on the melody and the various layers of instrumentation that builds over time. I think I'm proud of myself for not overcomplicating this tune.
Yeah, let me play. So it's about 3:34 here, the first time the what I call the big spike comes in. So you're saying this the first time that happens, that was the drummer deciding to do that, or that was just in the part? Okay, because then you use that to end the song, I believe.
Yep, and a drummer that originally came up with that was not Antoine. I was playing live, and Jeff Becker was the bass player I was playing with, and Matt Johnson. Becker is in a band called 90 Pound Wuss, and Johnson was famous for Roadside Monument, was the band that he was in years ago. But they suddenly leaned into that as a band, and I was like, wow, that takes us into a whole new level. And so I kept it ever since. You know, every drummer that plays with me now is like, wait, what are we doing back on the end?
Like, well, let's move back even further to the title track from Earthside Down, which, you know, talk about killer riffs, as we heard with the song we started the whole episode off with, the Forest from the Tree. And the one we just heard, here's another one that just really, you know, actually it wasn't until I started zooming in with the headphones and taking notes on this that I noticed that it doesn't just start in a void like a Pink Floyd song, that it actually starts with this drum machine that you had programmed, but turned way the hell down so that it's giving us like actually a pretty jaunty rhythm before this, mm-hmm. this thing comes in. Yeah. Do you want to say a little about it? I'm even prematurely getting the details before they hear it, but I wanted to, you know, alert people to listen to that. Yeah. Do you want to say a little about just where you were at with this album and this song in particular before we hear it?
Yeah. So this kind of introduces an open tuning that I will use from this point forward in most of my career. And this came from listening to Sunny Day Real Estate's first album. When you listen to Jeremy Enoch and Sunny Day Real Estate's work, there's always this like dominant seventh chord that they, I'm not a big music theory guy, so if I screw this up, you know, people can correct me, but they use kind of this like seventh chord where the seventh on top of the root creates this dissonance. And I love that. That's, again, the little bit of the emo part of me. And so this tuning for Earthside Down does that. It plays off of that seventh. So that's what was kind of going on there.
So it's not just a drop D?
No. I have to have an extra guitar with me when I play material that uses this opening, because the G string goes all the way down to, I can't remember, but when you retune it back up, you're going to break strings. So this started the complication of me bringing extra guitars around on tour.
Drop D is pretty much as adventurous as I get, because then I still basically know what I'm doing. But if I do any more than that, or, you know, an open tuning, I can screw around with that. But like anything beyond that, I haven't investigated much.
Yeah, this is an E tuning. So it's the root note is your standard E. But the G goes down and the D string goes up.
Okay. Well, here it is. Earthside Down.
Down.
convention and a soundbite. Never mind the prophets at your door. You want a motorcycle ride. You want a motorcycle ride. It's never what you want. I'm always upside down. It brings you down. Never what you want. I'm always upside down. I'm not your debutante. Putting faith upon your fear. It's never what you want. I'm always upside down. It's never what you want. 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 This is what you get. There's nothing here to hide.
All right, so again, you have a very distinctive guitar riff, but then the bass comes in something even cooler. Is he just riffing off of you? And he really like makes it move some of the breaks. Well, let me hit even higher, weirder notes to fill this out. Yeah, Herbie Flowers was the one who plays on Take a Walk on the Wild Side. I looked that up while we were talking.
Interesting.
And this sort of, you know, reminds me of that kind of extra oomph.
So this, I believe, is Greg on bass. Let me double check.
It says Greg Coates in what? Yeah,
Greg Coates plays this, and that was definitely all him. And I bet he was influenced by that bassist that you mentioned. Flowers is the name?
Yes, Herbie Flowers. Yep.
Yeah, it would not surprise me at all that he was influenced by that.
And I see it's Anthony Arvizu again on drums, and then
yep,
Stephen Hodges on percussion from Tom Waits. I interviewed Mike Baghetta a couple years ago, who has Steve Hodges plays in his band. This sort of sloshing around stuff, is that what I characterized as your drum machine? Was there a drum machine first, or you know, is there always?
I'm not entirely sure, but I think this is Steve in the background.
Okay.
Yeah. Steven produces this album with Antoine. Steven is a huge part of my career, becomes a musical mentor very early on, going back to days like these. He appears on a lot of my records.
I gravitated toward this song as I was listening through your catalog. I just feel like when the chorus comes in and you get that third chord before it brings you down, it just really warms you up, you know, given the strength of the initial riff. I mean, again, it's not terribly unlike In Structure Uncertain there. We picked three pretty slow songs, and the fourth one is not going to be a lot faster. But that's most of your catalog, right? I mean, was there a period on those first two albums? Were you more in the grunge pocket, or were you always the mellow
those
slow
little,
stuff?
Those cassettes that I did early on? Yeah. They're more kind of just wonky folk songs. And I think most of my tempos are kind of walking tempos.
Sure.
You know, it's funny. I started out as a drummer. That was my thing. I kind of stepped down from being a drummer because there were certain tempos I couldn't keep up with. And I think it reflects a little bit in my songwriting as well. Some songs like Uncertain, the drummer will have to kind of pull me back because they're deliberately slower, where I'll want to push it to more of a walking tempo. And there's a couple of tunes that are a little bit more brisk, but this does seem to be a thing that I just naturally kind of fall into.
Lyrically, the blame it on the satellites, damn the rocket ships, you shot them way too high. Is this another sort of just Icarus thing like we had in the first song where you're somebody is being a little too ambitious? Or was this a specific like anti-technology sentiment?
No, this is more kind of reacting against the idealism of our culture and not wanting to be put on any kind of pedestal.
Okay. And then the second verse, if you draw me into light with all the clamor of your kiss, it leaves me downward spiraling. unless the clamor of your kiss is not meant to refer to a specific person, but is more praise and adulation in general.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. All right. So,
you know, this is when I first got signed and I was getting a lot more attention as a songwriter that I didn't quite know how to handle. It made me feel very awkward. I suppose it still does. I think I was kind of writing to that aspect of suddenly being someone that people want to know or follow or come to shows and just sort of the awkwardness of that. Not to make myself like something I'm not.
No, I'm just trying to put the times together. So this is 98. This is sort of when, and you were in Seattle at the time or you were in LA?
I'm in the LA area all the way through 13 Stories. And that's where I make a break for Seattle.
Okay.
So I'm living in Long Beach, California and cutting my teeth in that music community there.
So I kind of wanted to ask you when we were talking about the apology to my wife thing of sort of how so many musicians like, okay, they tour all the time and they just have to have a spouse. They probably are divorced. if not more than once, and you know, and then eventually maybe they found somebody who was like also in the industry or just, you know, was comfortable with this thing and knew what they were getting into and not. And then most musicians I talk to like have to do something else to support themselves. Do you have a day job now? Have you always had one?
We're talking about Earthside Down. So this is where I began touring significantly. And I'm basically Henry Rollins getting into a van and playing bar after bar after bar and loving that part of my life. It was so exciting. I wasn't making any money, but I was paying a band. And that to me felt like a huge success that I was able to leave my hometown and pay all my guys enough to step away from their jobs and that kind of stuff. And meeting people and developing relationships across the country and even internationally. We did, was it New Zealand? But anyway, I'm getting lost in the weeds there. So all of that takes a toll on a relationship. And, you know, my wife and I kind of agreed at some point that let's not be any longer than, I forget what it was, 4 weeks at a time, but mm-hmm. you know.
And still, you didn't have kids at the time, so.
No, mm-mm. Back then, whenever I was home, I would find ways of making a living by doing graphic arts in some way, shape, or form. But it was never a stable thing. I was a subcontractor for technology company in town that I, when I was home from tour, I would step into the office and I would just wait around for work. And when I got it, it paid well. And when I didn't, it didn't, right? Somewhere along the line, over all this time of touring, I stumbled into this group of people up in Seattle that were all therapists. And I was really taken by them. Both my wife and I got really interested about the aspect of maybe going into a psychology degree and doing therapy as a living. And so that was part of our move to Seattle, is that was my goal of the new day job, because I loved what I realized about traveling and being with people on the road and staying in people's homes and or sleeping on their couches or whatever, is just the relationships, hearing their stories year after year. You know, I would stay with the same people every year and catch up on their lives. And that's one of the things I absolutely loved about mentoring. In a way, that's a little bit what therapists do. It's just daily. So in 2003, we went to Seattle and I enrolled in a graduate program there. And in 2006, I started a private practice. And so I do that 3 days a week in my private practice.
Remotely or with people in the same room with you?
Well, it gradually grew to a practice of others. And so I not only work directly with clients, but I also have a team of folks that I supervise with. And that makes it a lot less lonely in a way. I have a great team of people I love. There's about five of us in the practice. It's another real joy that I have, sitting with people and hearing their stories and walking with them in those places.
I was more trying to figure out, like, can you still tour and then you're doing sessions over Zoom or something, which presumably you had to do during the pandemic anyway.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. No, once I step out on the road, it's an all-encompassing thing, and it's the only thing I'm thinking about, which is what, you know, makes... You know, that's what makes it hard in a relationship too, right? But that's what the thing I love about touring is that it's a singular focus where when I'm at home, I'm managing all kinds of different things at the same time. So what I've done over the years is I've been very strategic about performances to where I will fly out to the areas that I used to tour and I will spend 4 or 5 days in the region and, you know, rent a car or whatever and play those various places, or sometimes it's just a single show. And I'm pretty nimble about it. A lot of times I just will do a house concert, and those are actually very meaningful to me. Kind of depends. If there's other people in the region and a good bill, then I'll do a club date. Otherwise, I'll play a house to 40 people. Both environments are really, you know, interesting to me. One is more intimate and one is a little bit more sonic, right? And you got a good sound system and that kind of thing.
Well, and I'm sure folks are wondering about your live sound as compared to your studio one. Luckily, you have a live album that I believe there's even a version of this song on it, the Earthside Down.
There's a solo live album where I'm opening for the band Low in Los Angeles. And there's a band live album where I'm returning to Long Beach after many, many years and playing with a lot of those original Earthside Down people, including mm-hmm. Greg Coates and Antoine Arvizu, and playing to my original kind of fan base there. And that's a very lovely live recording.
That is the one I was thinking of. Well, to finish up here, I had suggested that we put on this one from your first available record, Days Like These, 1994, Rockabye. It's the closing song on there, featuring Victoria Williams, who is someone who fascinates me. I had interviewed Peter Case's her ex-husband a couple of years ago. I'm looking at her discography. It looks like she hasn't recorded much recently. So I hadn't reached out to her to try to talk to her, but really fascinating, strange voice. But I also wasn't expecting. So I saw, you know, it's right in the title that it features her. And so I thought, oh, that's her singing at the very beginning. No, that's you in your falsetto. And then when she comes in, it's very obvious like that it's her.
Yeah.
That's not. But I just, yeah. I thought this was... Oh, this is strange. You're just having, I mean, I did that once. I had Lucy Lawless at my disposal. And so I had her just sing the lead part. And then I come in and help her on the court and the bridge and things like that. But like, I thought that's what you were doing here, but no, she's actually just featured in the latter part of the song. Do you even recall, was this supposed to be you by yourself? Do you do this live? Can you sing even higher the part that she is singing? Or was this written sort of with her in mind or with her?
Oh yeah. You're bringing up something really funny. When I was touring in those days in the mid 90s, I had this little shtick where when I played this song, I would mimic her voice, and I got really good at it. It just cracked people up because they never expected my voice to be able to do that.
Could do some Tiny Tim covers.
Yeah, right. But you're right. This first album, you know, folks kind of joked, this is your Mitch Easter voice. I, you know, began to utilize different parts of my voice.
Also just a different side of you. It's just a more overtly sentimental song. There's religious themes, which I don't recall hearing elsewhere in your catalog.
Well, I came from a religious background and upbringing. It's a part of my life that I've deconstructed and reconstructed several times. But this song was important to me because I think one of the things that a lot of people that grew up in cultures like this will say is that it's always positive, even though the literature of, you know, spiritual cultures, Christian culture, is very, very much about sort of leaning into poverty of spirit and the ability to mourn and those really good things about humanity. And yet the culture itself seems to resist that, which is off-putting and doesn't feel very authentic. And so this song, which I think Victoria really gravitated towards, was about kind of grasping the sorrow in life and not running from it spiritually, and to allow that authentic experience of our lives, of whatever does occur in our lives. Because if you can't mourn for something, then you truly can't have joy, is kind of the argument of this tune. As human beings, we're a rich palate, and if we start dumbing part of that down, it's kind of sad. So naturally, Victoria's had a lot of hardships to overcome in her life physically with having MS. And
okay, so that's why she doesn't record at this point, presumably.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
It might just be that she's content, you know, living out in the desert and doesn't want to step back into more of a public life. But she has shown up on a couple occasions on my records, and she does have a very significant part, the very last song on Heart Like Feathers. She sort of makes a little return on that album. That might have been one of the last recordings I've heard her do. I would love it if you ended up interviewing her. I'd love to hear that. Be sure to let me know if you get a hold of her and she's willing. But that's a little bit of how this song started. She was living in Los Angeles. I reached out to her, told her how much I adored her music, and we became fast friends. And this song was not initially supposed to be a duet, but it ended up becoming that.
So was it annoying then when a few years later I had to look up, the song's called Rockabye, and like, wasn't there a crappy song in the 90s? Yes, it's Sean Mullins' Lullaby. So I assume when that came out, did that spoil this song a little for you or anything?
No, we walk in such different circles that I don't think it's ever affected me.
All right. Well, thanks for chatting. I think people will enjoy your catalog if they dip into it. And this is a cool tune.
Thank you for the many beautiful questions. I love how you've dug into the discography and the actual intimacies of the recordings. It's neat to have questions like that.
Here's Rockabye. Rockabye, baby. Thanks so much to Robert. It's robertdiebel.com. And again, the headquarters for this podcast is nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. You'll see a widget on that page to show you how to leave a nice rating and review on wherever you're listening to this. I would love for you to do that. I've recorded some additional episodes already. My next one is with John S. Hall from King Missile. And then I just talked to a British singer-songwriter named Landy Hecht, who was a member of a punk band named Muncie Girls and now is solo. But perhaps you want to look up those two names to listen in advance with my conversations. I don't know. If you want to support this effort, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. Or if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, that is listening specifically to the Nakedly Examined Music feed, you can just press that subscribe button. It'll charge you a little money. And in fact, if you do that through Apple, you'll be promoted to the ad-free feed for this and my Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast, and my Philosophy versus Improv podcast. Hope you're all doing well, using music as a refuge from all the political strife going on. In whatever way you can, keep on musicking. Till next time, this is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.